Designer.com podcast. We've just been making sure we can count properly. Scott can't be with us this week because he's in India on the vague pretense of him being there purposes of employment, but we know better. I will be joined this time by Drew Tavendale, as always. Say hello, Drew.
Hello, Drew.
I knew you were going to do that. And, yeah, we've got some good films to talk about this time, as always at this time of year. So without further ado, let's crack on. So listen, Drew, it's February. We've just had January. That's the way months work.
Yeah, it's the way they tend to go. It's a pattern I've noticed, certainly.
They're so predictable. And it's as always, it's a fairly good time of year for, you know, for a random pop down to the cinema, is it not?
Yeah, January, February typically being particularly good months to be a cinemaphile in Britain. Get a lot of the films that are just crammed in for Oscar and BAFTA nominations. Have the problem, actually, perhaps the first couple of weeks of January, there was more or less sod all to see, and suddenly there was too much to see.
The floodgates doth open.
Indeed.
But yeah, it's that time of year, we've spoken about it before, where you could sort of could head down there and sort of throw a stone, and there's a good chance that whatever film it hit would be worth seeing. It's a time to cherry pick, certainly, if you want to check out all that stuff. So tonight, we are going to kick off by talking about 127 Hours. It's Danny Boyle's latest effort, and it's the true life tale of Aaron Ralston, a climber, canyoneer, and all-round outdoor extreme pursuits type, who very nearly came a lonesome cropper in May of 2003 when he became trapped in a canyon in Utah, his arm crushed between the wall and a rather large boulder. Having run out of water after 5 days alone in what would soon become his tomb, Aaron made the decision to take the only implement available to him, a blunt knife, and use it to amputate his own arm, as one does. In the movie, Ralston is portrayed by a very much on-form James Franco, taking time out between stoner comedies Pineapple Express and Your Highness to give his best performance since City by the Sea. As the film is essentially a one-hander, the rest upon young Franco's shoulders are great weight indeed, and there's always the danger that a misjudged performance in such circumstances can help sink an actor's career. There should be no such problem for Franco, however, with numerous award nominations, including a shot at Best Actor at this year's Oscars. Boyle directs with as assured a hand as one might expect, despite concern with the accident happening so early on in the movie. There's an awful lot of celluloid left to fill before Ralston gets to walk in daylight once more, albeit a couple of pounds lighter. Despite a good 75% of the movie being shot in that one cramped location, Boyle makes excellent use of Ralston's increasingly fevered notes to the video camera he had taken with him on the trip to guide the viewer on an emotional journey that climaxes, for those sturdy enough of stomach, with the unflinchingly graphic act of Heath Robinson's surgery. I wasn't entirely sure what to expect of 127 Hours, Drew. I should imagine a lot of people would have been in the same position I was in that I knew that the guy had to cut his arm off, and that's probably why a lot of people are going to go and see this film, but I think that would probably be missing the point, because it's a very good film.
Well, I would say good at least. I would suggest that means I didn't like it quite as much as you did, but certainly good. And yeah, that would be a ridiculous reason to see a film just because somebody cuts his arm off, particularly when
that's what the Saw movies are for.
Yes, it's not quite as graphic as you might expect, though. Perhaps I'm quite sure, in fact, that it's considerably more affecting than anything in the Saw films. My mind just gave a sudden grinding halt there.
Did it?
What did you ask me?
I didn't really ask anything. I just kind of went, it's a good film, isn't it? It's one of those, it's a one-hander, and as such, it very much rests on the capabilities of its lead, but Franco does a fantastic job. If I had any complaints to make, I would say that it's not the most electrifying film, but then it's not essentially about this guy cutting his arm off. I suppose it's more about his transition from a carefree and by his own admission as well, a very sort of selfish man who didn't make much time for his family, realising that actually there's a lot more to life than running about a canyon, and had he not been so silly and negligent of people, he might have spoken to his mum on the phone when she called the night before he left, and she would know where he was, and he might not be facing the prospect of amputating his own arm.
Exactly, yeah, if he hadn't been such a loner and an idiot, quite frankly, he would be in this situation.
We're sure he's a nice guy, but yeah, he was a bit of an idiot.
Yeah, I mean, he's not like he's particularly unlikable, he's not a horrible person, he's just a bit stupid, perhaps a bit self-centred, but not an unlikable character.
The kind of guy who early on in the film, when he comes over the handlebars of his bike and he's lying sort of face down in the dirt, the first thing he thinks to do is reach into his pocket, get his phone out and take a picture of himself.
Probably says quite a lot about him. As you're saying about James Franco having a lot to do, being a one-hander, I think possibly suffers from having a bit too much to do. He doesn't suffer, I think the film does. This made me think about a bit was Buried, which we talked about a few months ago on our podcast, where Ryan Reynolds was trapped in a box and there was just him on screen for the whole running time.
He was trapped in a box with Gwyneth Paltrow's head.
There was always some upsides to being trapped in a box. It means Gwyneth Paltrow didn't have her head. That was an excellent and surprising performance from him. But while it was just to him on screen for the entire running time, he did have more to do than Franco did, because he had interaction, albeit that he was acting it, but with using a telephone, etc. Franco basically has nothing, so I think even if he hadn't had his video camera with him, they would probably have had to write that in so he had something to do. Because there's a few flashbacks, etc., where he's talking to other people, and I also felt they didn't add another great deal to the film. And so you're basically left with this guy in a canyon all on his own, and the only person he has to talk to is himself. And I think the film suffers slightly for that, and that it was just a bit too empty at points. But having the video camera talking to himself did bring out the few really outstanding bits where he imagines himself on a US talk show, so examining his own life and his own foolishness and his predicament. And that's just a fantastic scene that in lesser hands would have just been probably cheesy, certainly awful, and certainly should get very strong, very big plaudits for that. It's not the most fantastic film I've seen.
It's kind of... I really enjoyed it. I can see where you're coming from. I think probably do you see it as kind of a one-trick pony? I suppose that once, you know, you're there for the big event sort of thing, and I think once that's done, if I were to go back again immediately now and re-examine the film, I'm sure I'd probably find more to pick fault with. But I really enjoyed just my first viewing of it. I think I'm probably going to wait until, you know, it's broadcast on terrestrial to catch up with it again, because I don't think it's not exactly Inception. It's not something that you can view from a whole lot of different angles and pick up some various things and subtleties on a second viewing. But I mean, as far as this sort of thing goes, I thought it was very well directed by Boyle. I suppose quite reserved as well. I was quite surprised maybe at how reserved he was. I know he's not the most over the top and visually flashy director, but his work can be a lot more kinetic.
There's generally an awful lot of action going on. In his stuff, and that is kind of stymied there, really, isn't he? Because nothing's happening. The only thing that really moves, other than some water along some tubes, is a raven. His normal
never work with children, animals, or liquids in tubes.
It's more kinetic style is definitely stymied a bit.
I suppose he makes the only sensible choice, which is actually, rather than fight it, is to go with the stillness of it for much of the running time, I suppose. As a director, he must have had to have put a great deal of trust in his leading man.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I clearly didn't like it quite as much as you, but certainly it's worth the watch. Franco's performance is very strong. The problems
I don't
that
think,
have
I don't think it's Oscar strong, because I think there seems to be too much weight behind certain other candidates who we'll speak about later, but
people have spoken about in previous months, like Jesse Eisenberg as well. Yeah, I don't think Franco's up to that standard. Not necessarily because his performance, as I say, there's not quite enough for him to do, I think.
No.
Because he's a man stuck in a canyon. There's a limited amount you can do with that.
Exactly.
And I think possibly the title of the film does a bit of a disservice to it as well. Ralston's book that he wrote was called Between a Rock and a Hard Place.
Yeah.
Not the most original titles, but it kind of made sense. Whereas 127 hours suggests a countdown. After about the first, maybe 12 hours after he's checked his watch when he falls into the canyon, and he checks a few times after that. After that, the time becomes an irrelevance. He's not aware of time.
Yeah.
It's not really known how it's counting. And you don't actually get to see the watch an awful lot after that. A couple on-screen messages, perhaps, to say what day it was.
Yeah.
But other than that, time becomes meaningless and it's dictated by water. So if it'd been called like 127 milliliters or something, it might have had more meaning.
Have you been waiting for this whole thing to come out with that gag?
No, honestly, that just occurred to me in the last 2 seconds.
Bravo, sir, bravo. Now, around these parts, the arrival of a new directorial effort from Clint Eastwood is a thing to be welcomed. I haven't had the chance to catch up with Hereafter, his latest, but I know a man who has, and I suspect he's going to fill us in on it. Drew, tell us about Hereafter.
Okay, I will. It's a Clint Eastwood directorial effort, so you think, that's pretty good. It's, you have to say, though, that going to watch this film was a bit of a gamble.
Mm.
On the one hand, as you've alluded to, you've got direction by Clint Eastwood, you've got a script by the man responsible for The Damned United, The Last King of Scotland, and Frost Nixon, and a starring role from Matt Damon. And on the other hand, you have psychics and discussion of what happens after death.
Hmm.
Alas, however, I lost this gamble and the forfeit was having to watch Hereafter. The stories.
But Drew, before we go any further, the sort of the trailers for this, the commercials for this on television are saying, they're throwing quotes at the screen saying Eastwood's masterwork.
Well, then I must be wrong and they must be right.
You must be.
The story, such as it is, and we'll get on to whether it's a masterwork or not in a few minutes. concerns three people who have experience of, or at least want to know about, the hereafter. Firstly, there's Marie, a reporter for France 2 television, who almost dies after the resort she's holidaying in is struck by a tsunami. Her experience of the rather stereotypical bright white light during the time she was dead changes her life and prompts her to investigate the meaning of the images seen in people's near-death experiences. Second character is George, played by Matt Damon, a genuine psychic amongst a world of charlatans, who considers his ability to communicate with the departed loved ones of people he encounters a curse, rather than the money-making opportunity he previously used it as. And lastly, there's Marcus, a young boy who struggles to come to terms with a family tragedy, and tries every fraud out there in an attempt to communicate with the person he's lost. Switching between Paris, London, and San Francisco, we follow the lives of these three as they deal with their individual problems. What had me worried watching this, and the way the film felt for perhaps the first half, was that it was heading towards some Babel-like, incredibly tenuous connection of people's lives. But instead, it just goes for coincidence presented as destiny. Almost a pity, I would say, as it, if it had tried pretension on Babel's scale, I could have at least enjoyed myself a little getting angry with it. But Hereafter is just too dull to care about. Psychics and similar nonsense tend to get me worked up. But while this convilm? I invented a new word for it.
Oh dear.
While this film's conventionally bad, rather than pretentiously so, it's also very conventionally boring, and seems to last at least an hour longer than it actually does. And the fact that it's just outright boring is the film's biggest problem, though it's far from its only one. Cécile de France, who plays Marie, is a reasonably engaging presence on screen, but Matt Damon is unusually subdued, and the kid who plays Marcus is, well, without wishing to be too unkind, he's there. Much like some meat might be. Or a lamppost. Though I'd be unsurprised to find street lighting could act better. There's also a strange inconsistency of character, particularly the journalist Marie. She's presented as a hard-hitting, dogged Paxman type, you know, never willing to take easy answers or ask easy questions. But when one, as a whole, one woman tells her that the things people with near-death experiences see can't be coincidence or physiological, Marie more or less says, "Yes, you must be right. I will now ruin my career and investigate this." You know, Hereafter thinks it's far deeper and more meaningful than it actually is. But when something genuinely serious is brought up, during George's tentative attempts at romance with his cooking class partner, it actually feels forced and cliched. And this is all rather surprising, not so much from Eastwood perhaps, whose directorial resume certainly isn't flawless, but certainly from screenwriter Morgan, I'm left wondering too if old Clint picked this project just because he's getting on a bit, and has been wondering himself what happens after death. My guess, at least if you've been particularly wicked, is that you have to watch stuff like this for eternity.
So you loved it then?
Oh, it was awesome.
Convilm. Adjective. a conventionally terrible film. Darren Aronofsky is a man whose name carries some weight around these parts. The man has three bona fide classic films to his name from a possible four, and he looks to make it four from five with Black Swan, another of award season's hot topics, starring Natalie Portman as a ballet dancer slipping into insanity. Nina Sayers is cast as a delicate white swan in a production of Swan Lake, but her mind begins to falter and she becomes more like the devious Black Swan. That probably means something to you if you're familiar with Black Lake.
Black Lake. Swan. Didn't think I could do.
Black Lake, man, Black Lake. I would never summon the spectre of Black Lace on this podcast. If you know anything about Swan Lake, then you know a lot more than I do. If it were anyone else's film, I'd probably give Black Swan a miss. But given Aronofsky's proven skill at making films that feel as though the viewer is party to someone else's nightmare, and my particular liking for that kind of thing, my interest has been somewhat piqued. Drew, what saith ye?
Well, your interest certainly ought to be piqued. I know, I certainly know the music of Swan Lake. I know nothing about it, but about the ballet, and I've no interest in ballet. I certainly allowed the fact that it was a Darren Aronofsky film to be more than enough to make me want to see it. As you mentioned, Natalie Portman plays Nina, who's been a professional ballerina for a while and has been waiting for a chance for a larger role. And when the new season's performance of Swan Lake is announced and that the director, Thomas, is looking for a new Swan Queen, Nina's determined to get it. Now, the difficulty here for her is that the dual role of the Swan Queen is one where she's got to be good and bad at the same time. She's practiced often and she even dreams about the Swan Queen, so it's her perfect role. Unfortunately, while she can flawlessly dance the part of the virginal, elusive white swan, Thomas doesn't believe she can play the black swan, the seductive sexual counterpart, and Nina must prove to him and herself that she can. And the issue, of course, is at what cost does that come? The apparent dichotomy of the two characters, White Swan and Black, takes its toll on Nina's psyche, and she gradually begins to lose her grip on reality as she gets a better hold of the role. Aronofsky himself has made it clear that he considers Black Swan a companion piece to his acclaimed The Wrestler, another favourite around these parts, and it's clear to see why. Both films portray the grit and sweat, the physical punishment and the mental toll of achieving and dealing with success in the main character's chosen field, albeit with Natalie Portman's Nina on the way up in Black Swan, whereas Mickey Rourke's Randy was in the twilight of his career in The Wrestler. Both films, too, expose the grimy, unglamorous backstage world of the profession, with only occasional glimpses of the polished final product that they worked so hard to produce. The films also examine the tensions and politics between performers, though it may or may not be a surprise that the powerful, testosterone-fueled men in The Wrestler typically treat each other rather better than the beautiful young women of New York Ballet do. I should mention too, as I alluded to earlier, that an unfamiliarity with, or dislike of even, the film's setting need not matter. I thought The Wrestler superb, but I have absolutely no time for wrestling, though I do suspect ballet fans will get more of it than I did. Or at least when Nina is instructed to dance a piece again and told that it is much better the second time, won't be left thinking, as I was. That appeared to be exactly the same as the first time. She's just sort of spinning around, right?
Yeah. You uncultured oaf.
Black Swan is at times an assault on the senses. Director of photography Matthew Libatique's grainy, gritty portrayal of ballet's backstage will be suddenly suffused with light and colour as Nina takes to the stage, and Clint Mansell's clattering, clanging score, mingled with Tchaikovsky's rousing orchestration, attempts to overwhelm your ears. The performances from the cast are generally excellent too, though Winona Ryder's deposed prima ballerina Beth strikes a discord. Whether because she's miscast or the character doesn't work, I can't quite decide, but either way, it just doesn't fit in there. Barbara Hershey is suitably creepy as Nina's overbearing, overprotective and somewhat unhinged mother, and Mila Kunis lends strong support as the effortlessly sensual dancer Nina must be like to play the Black Swan. It's Portman though who gets all the plaudits, and rightly so. I've never seen her better. Now, Do you see what people can do when given a decent script and good direction? Do you, George? Do you see? Do you see, George? Fuck off, George.
Why was Black Swan over and above all other films an opportunity to have a go at Lucas?
It was on my head. Just I was thinking. Just like,
take it, George.
At times, the film feels a little too interested in the artistic process, to the point where it's in danger, at least, of becoming self-indulgent. And the imagery of mirrors is perhaps a little overdone. And the character of Nina is also colder, harder, and less sympathetic than was Mickey Rourke's Randy Robinson, which may put some off, but I would hope not. I mean, it's not a perfect film, and I can certainly understand why people wouldn't like it, with the elements of psychological horror in it as well as the drama. But Natalie Portman's performance is outstanding, and that alone is reason enough to recommend it. Hmm. Fortunately, that isn't the only reason, and it's certainly worth a look, especially for anyone who enjoyed The Wrestler.
Yay! I suppose we should talk about another one of the awards favourites currently. Colin Firth is, without doubt, Britain's go-to man of the decade. Since Hugh Grant's increasing avoidance of the limelight left something of a power vacuum in the sphere of well-heeled, well-spoken gentleman types, Firth has stepped up to the mark to fulfil his destiny. His latest role in The King's Speech seems to have cemented his leading man status and earned him front-runner odds at a great many awards dues into the bargain. In it, he plays King George VI, Britain's reluctant monarch between the Great Wars, and a man impeded by an unfortunately serious stutter at a time when radio addresses to the nation were the norm. So there you go. The stage seems set for an awards-baiting film from the very start, what with the borderline costume drama kind of historical elements, and also someone who has to overcome a physical impairment. Would you describe a stutter as a physical impairment, Drew?
Yeah, I think you would. Yeah. I think there's psychological elements, but there's a physical impairment. Yeah, and if you look at the character's body language, which is based on the screenwriter himself was a stammerer. When he was young, it's based on partly on his experiences, knows what he's talking about. There is a physical element to it, yeah.
I have to say that I went into The King's Speech. This is a problem with a film sort of achieving sort of awards hype before it gets screened in this country. That you can often sort of go in with a great weight of expectation and not necessarily have it completely fulfilled. And I did really enjoy The King's Speech, which I should say at this point, I suppose, is the tale of King George VI's, or certainly a fictionalisation of his unorthodox relationship with his speech therapist, Lionel Logue. I did enjoy it immensely, and first performance is very, very good, but I feel it's perhaps been slightly overburdened by expectation.
I suppose that's a possibility. That wasn't really an issue for me. I think the issue for me more was, it's about the royal family.
Yeah.
I'd like it to be angry or bored.
No likers of they are we.
Indeed. Fortunately, though, it's quite a human story. The fact that Colin Firth's character is a member of the royal family is not entirely relevant. It's more that he's a public figure and needs to speak is the issue. And it's excellent. I had been slightly concerned, I said, because of the subject matter. It turns out it's basically there's a man with great pressures upon him. He's a public figure. He has to speak. He struggles with it. And then he has a relationship with a friend, or a man that becomes a friend, helps him get over this. And it's a very human story. It's the reason that he has to get over it in a particular time is historical pressure of the impending World War II. And the fact he's a public figure.
The need to match Hitler's address at the... Wasn't it the Nuremberg rallies, was it? It was after that, wasn't it? I can't remember. It's not a necessity, really, is it? Anyway,
I can't remember.
Yes.
Yeah,
to place it in context, here was a man who a great many people considered to be a bit of a bumbling oaf and a bit of an embarrassment to the country, who was faced with the prospect of matching the speech of a man who, obviously, a terribly vile man, but history shows was an incredibly charismatic speaker. And
yeah,
a very
well, I think
speaker.
Yeah, because Hitler was a demagogue, and you don't get to become a demagogue unless you're incredibly charismatic. Which is not the same as likeable. I think people would get confused if Hitler wasn't charismatic. Well, he obviously was.
Yes.
Yeah, at the same time as well as needing to sort of be this guiding voice to the nation during the war, and the fact that you're saying he was considered a bumbling oaf. At the time, also, apparently, stammering was, stuttering was considered a sign of feeble-mindedness. So it was generally thought to be not all there in the head, which is disgusting, quite frankly, but that's the way it was back then. You can't change it.
That's it. We're talking about the 30s, where I suppose medical science was still sort of 25% witchcraft.
Oh, yeah. Although that's surprising. There is the one scene early on where one of the suggestion being that he's been to see many, many speech therapists to try and get over this problem he has. And the one he visits near the beginning of the film tells him to put all these marbles in his mouth, and on which he almost chokes. Yeah, 19th century medicine, okay, that's basically quackery. 20th century medicine, it's actually science by then, but I guess he was a desperate man. He's tried almost everything, and people still do it nowadays. So
that's the thing about the King's Speech. I know a couple of people who've seen it and who also said they were sort of slightly underwhelmed by it, although they really did appreciate Colin Firth's turn. Tom Hooper, who I'm not entirely sure what Tom Hooper has directed before. Am I familiar with his body of works?
I don't know. Have you seen The Damned United, which Scott and I both very much
I didn't realise he directed it. Ah, okay.
Yeah, he directed The Damned United, which we thought was a very good character piece as well. Again, which is about a relationship about two colleagues and friends. Similarities to The King's Speech, certainly.
Before that, he's done, for the most part, TV work, including as far back as 1997, Biker Grove. There you go, for those of a certain age living in the UK.
He did do the HBO miniseries a few years ago of John Adams.
That's right.
With Paul Giamatti as the US second president, which was an excellent series as well, so he's certainly got a pedigree. Yeah.
He directs the film with a great deal of economy. I'm surprised perhaps more at... I think, has he been nominated for Best Director? I think he has, hasn't he?
I have absolutely no idea who's been nominated for what.
I'm fairly sure he was
nominated. I'll bow to your greater knowledge here.
I'm sure he was nominated for Best Director's Oscar. I found that a little bit surprising. Although, in fairness, it's very economically directed, but, I mean, very, very well so nonetheless. But obviously the man everybody's talking about is Colin Firth. My concern about the film is that a lot of people, I think, are going to watch it and say, oh, what a fantastic portrayal of that man with a stutter. What a fantastic performance that is. But I feel like that's kind of missing the point. The impression I was left with after I watched it is more that Colin Firth's achievement was actually to make this character, who could quite easily have been, I suppose, portrayed in a very alienating way to the audience, actually an incredibly likeable and relatable fellow. And the great part in that is that by the end of the film, obviously, the man's giving an address to the nation at a very dark time. But that in doing so, I suppose, in a sense, you can feel a certain amount of pride in the fellow, and you actually feel quite pleased that he's accomplished what he's accomplished. A simple thing like stepping up to a microphone, which for him might as well be climbing Mount Everest.
I mean, that sort of... that element's almost like the sporting underdog story, isn't it? And it's very crowd-pleasing in the end. You're almost cheering him on.
Yeah, and I think that's the power of Firth's performance. Not to detract from his inflections in his portrayal of the physical aspect of his stammer, which are, by and large, faultless, as far as I can tell. I mean, it was hugely convincing. But I think to review his performance on the basis of that alone is to miss... really, for me, 75% of what makes his performance a great performance. So I wasn't as impressed with it as a film as I was by Colin Firth's performance. And it'll be interesting to see how well he's rewarded. I think he won the Golden Globe, didn't he, for Best Actor? I'm not entirely sure.
I just don't care.
No.
Since I've, like you said, probably mentioned this in this podcast before, but
I think we've mentioned it many times.
I used to look forward to the Oscars and I'd be up all night watching it. I don't care anymore, and they're all wrong anyway, so...
Yeah, certainly, I mean, I haven't watched a heck of a lot of films again this year. I mean, I've watched more, but it would certainly be among the best couple of performances that I've seen, and in many ways, again, sort of quite understated, but, yeah, not a terrible film, but I think perhaps I enjoyed it less than I expected, purely because of the expectation I had going in. Green Hornet. Oh, look, it is a Green Hornet. Drew, tell us about the Green Hornet.
Must I?
Yes, you must. Oh, wait a minute now.
Very well
What's
done.
That tone of voice all about?
Perhaps I shall elucidate.
Yes.
The Green Hornet then. There have been two previous incarnations of the Green Hornet, as far as I'm aware. which is a tale of rich playboy Britt Reed's deeds as a vigilante crime fighter. Before this movie, there was a 1930s radio serial and a 1960s TV adaptation, the latter starring legendary martial artist Bruce Lee. I had been entirely unaware of them, and blissfully it would seem, if this is any measure, because I just didn't know about them before watching writer Seth Rogen's take on the story at all. I had reasonably high expectations though, not least because of Rogen's track record in script writing in the past few years, coupled with the presence of Michel Gondry in the director's chair. Now Rogen himself takes the lead as Reed, an immature, overgrown frat boy who spends his time partying and seducing women. After the sudden death of his newspaper mogul father, played by Tom Wilkinson, he decides to do something more useful with his life, and uses his inherited fortune to fight crime. He's aided in this by Kato, played by Jay Chou, his father's mechanic and barista, a technological genius. Oh, yep, he is, he's barista. A technological genius with almost superhuman martial arts skills, who also happened to have constructed bulletproof cars with added weapon systems. For some reason.
Well, as one does.
Indeed. Not that the inspiration to fight crime came from any moralistic or altruistic motive. No, Kato and Britt begin because they're really, really drunk and think it'd be cool to be superheroes. And I think it would be appropriate here to make a comparison with another superhero movie of recent times, and that's Iron Man. There are strong similarities here. You know, you've got a rich playboy and a man with extreme technological ability, albeit that in Iron Man, they're the these two are the one and the same person, and the Green Hornet two individuals, working with money left them from a company started by their father, realising through unexpected circumstance that they could use these factors to improve the world, even if their own glory is the main motivating factor. And I make this comparison in particular though, because I think it allows me to sum up quite succinctly for you what the Green Hornet is like. Now I'd like you to imagine Iron Man. Now, take away almost all of the humour and all of the charisma. And there you have the Green Hornet. Not good sounding, is it? The charisma is a really big issue, because absolutely no one in the film has any. A great deal of which I think must be due to the writing. Christoph Waltz, so compelling a villain in Inglourious Basterds, no matter what the other film's faults may have been, is entirely wasted, being given only a few tired lines and an inferiority complex to work with. Cameron Diaz is perhaps the least unlikable, but her character is not so much underwritten as unwritten, and the innate authority brought by Edward James Olmos as the editor of Reed's newspaper is entirely squandered. The biggest culprit here is Rogen's character, the Green Hornet himself. The problem is that basically he's an incompetent jackass, and is so for the entire running time of the film. It could be argued that making the main hero a bumbling fool always rescued by his capable sidekick is putting a spin on the genre's stereotypes, but the character would still have to be likeable. And anyway, even Inspector Gadget's done that before. An ill-judged scene where Britt Reed jokes about Diaz's 30-something secretary being ancient compounds his unlikability is, it just feels cruel and nasty. Director Michel Gondry fails to make his mark on his film too. There's none of the quirkiness and whimsy that typically marks out his films, and the final act in particular, a tawdry and uninspiring gunfight and chase sequence, could have been produced by any of 100 Hollywood hacks. Not recommended.
It's a sure sign, isn't it? I mean, this project has been knocking about Hollywood for the best part of about 15 years or something like that. And then all of a sudden, as is usually the case with that kind of thing, it lands on the doorstep of a director who you probably wouldn't imagine in a million years being interested in this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And goodness knows why he's felt compelled to take it. One can only assume there was a bit of a headlock involved there, either, you know, literally or or from a career perspective. It's one of those where, look, we need you to take a hit on this, otherwise you don't get to make the next film you want to make. I was really surprised when I found that Michel Gondry was going to be directing this, because you know from the off it's going to be a stinker, surely. Something that's been knocking about in development hell for that long is not going to be a good film. I can't think of a single example where I could be proven wrong on that, which is not to say my knowledge is all-encompassing. I'm sure someone could think of one, but I've really no interest in seeing The Green Hornet, and as yet another retrofitted 3D film being shoved down our throats, I've had quite enough already. I was never going to see it.
My choice would have been to have watched it in 2D, but such a choice wasn't available.
Yeah.
And I watched it in 3D, and surprise, surprise, it makes no difference whatsoever.
That's the thing, it's annoying that I've checked the listings and things, and none of my local cinemas are showing a 2D version of this, which is odd, because normally you are given the option, but with this, and a film that I can't imagine them having had the money to even do it, sorry, to have retrofitted it particularly well, I wouldn't have imagined it was budgeted for that. I'm just surprised that that's the case. Why would they have felt the need in the first place? I don't know. There you go. It's one of those where I was worried to see or to have read some statement from the director saying how excited he was to have been given the project to work on. And it clearly wasn't the wording of Michel Gondry. It was quite clearly someone at the studio press department just going, Control-C, Control-V, from the Great Big Puff Piece copy-and-paste book.
Yeah, because I saw his name at the start, I think. And I got to the end of it and I was just really, really disliked the film. So I was kind of really irritated with it by the end. It was just because it was just rubbish. Yeah. And again, you've got a film with the central character is just an unlikable arsehole. That's not good.
Yeah.
So I finished the point on, which is that, and then the end credits came up and it said directed by Michel Gondry. Oh, I forgot about that. Really?
Yeah. If there's one thing you can say about any Michel Gondry film I've seen, whether I've enjoyed it or otherwise, it's that you know it's been directed by Michel Gondry.
Exactly, yeah. The problem with having a central character that's completely unlikable is down to the writing, I think. And it's weird because Seth Rogen has written stuff like Superbad and stuff. You know he can write funny stuff. Mm. So I guess maybe he just had an off day writing this. And it's not even a case that he himself can't play unlikable characters. Because if you've ever seen Observing Report, which is a pretty funny film, his character Ronnie Barnhart is a bit of a creepy arsehole. But still manages to pull it off in that film. So an off day at the office when he wrote this. But I certainly wouldn't recommend anybody saw it. Best avoided.
Boo, Green Hornet. Boo. I'm throwing rotten veg at it now. I think that was pretty much everything we had to cover this week, wasn't it, dude?
Indeed. I believe so.
The next time you hear from us, we will be three once more. Scott should be back from his tomb raiding experience in Deepest Darkest India. Right, yeah, let's just sit back and bask in the glory of what a good selection of films we had. Yeah, so fare thee well, guys. We will be back soon enough. I was Craig, and Drew was Drew.
Indeed I was. Fare thee well.
Yeah, take it easy. We'll speak to you soon.
Just trying to say the next word and couldn't. Thought, 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 and the next word begins with G.